Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
I'm here again with Stephen English, who's going to impart more wisdom to us investors on the macro picture and how we go about investing in it. Stephen, good morning to you.
Morning, Tamsin.
So let's talk about the UK public markets and the infrastructure of AIM. It's changed quite a lot.
Yeah. I'm not sure if people are that aware of what has happened. And by and large, regulation has been good. It's a large part of it, and it's ever thus. It's figured out how to win the last war. It's the bankers who almost blew the world up. We've all had the blowback from that from a compliance point of view. And if there's a bull market, that's probably set for another 20, 30 years. It's compliance. Anything compliance related, just buy it. And it's affecting us. But what's happened in particular, it's castrated the market making arms of the banks. These used to be big profit centers for the banks. But regulation, the way it's gone, one of the side effects from it is proprietary trading is seen as evil again, and you are no longer allowed to make markets in a genuine sense of the word. So their capital now for market makers, a lot of them have to have what we call flat books by the end of the week. They're not allowed to carry over any big positions over the weekend. So the chief risk officers are all over them. You've got your value at risk models, which aren't worth a carrot, but people think they are. But what it's done is remove a lot of capital. So in the past, when you get selling pressures, which we've seen in 04, you get market makers rightly doing the job of a market maker and taking a view. You start to mark the prices down, but they do absorb as well. So it acts as a stabilizer because they're able to absorb and take stock onto their own books. And then when it bounces back, they can sell it at higher levels, and difference between the bid offers where they make all the money. So they love volatility, love volume. Now what's happened though is that's much, much reduced. They've got far less capital, so it's gone to what's much more closely called a match bargain market. Very often, if we've got a line of stock, they're only going to take it on the books if they know they've got an immediate buyer on the other side, whereas in the past they would have took it on the books themselves. There was rumors when we saw Q4 going round. Well, I'll give you two anecdotes. The first one, a colleague in the city, he got rung up by a fund manager, naming no names obviously, but he said, I have got no bids for my stocks whatsoever. And this is unit trust manager who had to sell. I've got no bids whatsoever. I will give you X percent commission if you can get me a bid for any stock. And he's given his portfolio. And that's desperate. That's absolutely desperate. The rumor I heard that there was a market making firm who was one of the few who does have the ability to provide some liquidity. And it was bidding prices that were 5 or 10 pence below the bid and getting filled in stock. And you're shooting fish in a barrel when it comes to making money like that, because when the shock and awe of this liquidity shock, and it was only a liquidity shock, said at the time, I thought it was a head fake. When that wears off, you get this snapback, which we've seen, it's been a V-shaped recovery, and then they're selling it for excellent, excellent prices. So if you are deep-pocketed, I would urge anyone to become a market maker today if you had capital, because you are going to make, if you can provide liquidity today, you will earn an outsized return on that capital. So the stabilizer has gone. If you think of it like a car, you got your shock absorbers that absorb the bumps. That used to be the case. Now, if you think of a car with no shock absorbers, every divot you hit, it's just bang, bang, bang. Your doors are falling off like a clown's car.
And this is due to regulation.
It's all driven by regulation. Yeah.
So if you say you've got money, you start being a market maker, you're still going to be bound by that regulation, aren't you?
If you're part of a wider bank, so I don't even know if it's possible to be a pure market maker, but there are liquidity providers, or if you want to set up maybe a hedge fund, would be the best way of doing it to circumvent those rules. But some stocks were just getting given away because you had a forced seller on the other side. And when you got a technical move like that, if you can buy stocks for far less than they're actually worth, and you'll get, when it all settles down, you can then sell them again in short order. Yeah, maybe a hedge fund. People have to come in and fill that void because it's just exacerbating illiquidity. But it's not just equities, it's showing up in the bond market as well, which terrifies me. The proliferation of ETFs and a liquidity mismatch between an ETF wrapper and a bond, which is highly illiquid. I think that's the epicenter of the next event. I don't think we're going to see a solvency or credit crunch event. I think it's going to be a liquidity-driven shock to the system next. And it does terrify me in bonds in particular. But last year, the German Bund market, one of the most liquid assets in the world, for a period during the day, seized up. So it's not just that. And you're seeing flash crashes develop with more prevalence. Algorithms have perhaps got something to do with it. Algorithms are trained to do very similar things to the other algorithm. And when they start to see some selling pressure, they kind of all withdraw from the market immediately. So you've got high frequency trading going on, but when you're seeing a wall of money coming, they also switch off and down tools. So that bid has just been removed and you're seeing these big lurches down. So it's a systemic issue, I would argue. I think it's a worry. I think there was a well-intended meaning from the regulator in the sense of proprietary trading on the face of it. It sounds like it should be bad, but it wasn't people taking big positions in equities or bonds that blew up the market. It was junk bonds being repackaged with a AAA rating when they weren't actually AAA. So I think they're concentrated on the wrong aspect. And I think it's sown the seeds for the next event in markets. Say they figured out how to win the last war, but they haven't quite, and they've sown the seeds for the next war.
So the AIM market is notoriously illiquid anyway. Do you think it'll take more funds out of the AIM market because it's just impossible to have a market for the sort of size that you want to trade?
It's a very good question. It's something I have thought over. I think it comes down to the mismatching liquidity. If you're trying to provide daily liquidity when it doesn't exist, that's when the problems come to the fore. So I'm not saying unit trusts should be banned for small cap investments, but perhaps they should have weekly dealing or monthly dealing rather than daily, because it can become a self-perpetuating death spiral almost. When it comes to investments, they need to realize, or when they make contact with the enemy, they realize the enemy is actually themselves. And sometimes they need to be protected from themselves, where the selling begets selling. And it can just be as simple as that. Equity markets are random in many senses. It's a bit like a tectonic plate. It's why weather forecasting has improved immeasurably, certainly short-term weather forecasting. Earthquake forecasting is still very, very poor. And sometimes a tectonic shape will shift and it will cause nothing. Other times it'll be a shift and you've set an earthquake off. And it depends on the underlying fissures within the rocks. And it's the same with stock markets. Sometimes a wall of money will cause a transcendent cadence or a crash down thereafter. Other times it just shrugs its shoulders and carries on. So there's a randomness to market sell-offs, but people think there's a signal in all of that noise, and that's why selling begets selling. So investment trusts would be my favoured vehicle when it comes to small cap investing. There is always investments, and there should always be investments made. What I think should be happening more than it is, that's why you guys are doing a great job. It's trying to get more liquidity, more private investors engaged in terms of stock ownership. I think it's the best endeavour and hobby almost in the world. I think it's fascinating. So I'd encourage more investors to do it directly in that sense, if they've got the skills. Just providing liquidity, bigger funds, it is becoming more of an issue. Another consequence of regulation with MiFID II rules, I'm seeing far, far less ideas now. So I used to get all the research from all of the houses, all the brokers in London. Now you're having to pay for it. We're quite a small firm. We've got two that we're paying for. Some of them are still disseminating for free on house stocks. But if I wanted to take every single piece of research, it would be multiple hundreds of thousands of pounds. And that's a significant part of our operating profit. It's de minimis for a large bulge bracket long-only fund manager in London. It's rounding errors, a percent of their operating profit. So what it's done is it's putting pressure on the smaller operators, and it's causing them to either get acquired by the bigger boys. So rather than having 20 different smaller fund managers, perhaps you've only got 10 today or 5 today. And that feeds into less liquidity. There's less engagement, there's less buying and selling going on. It's far better to have 20 smaller people than one mega person who buys a lump of stock at IPO and then sits on it forevermore until something happens. It just flatlines. It's no good for anyone in that sense of the word. But liquidity and volatility isn't a problem per se if you're not a forced seller. And if you're a saver, You want volatility. You want to get that pound cost averaging. You want volatility because you're not consuming it. You're not going to start decumulating it down the line. So you want that. But it's also volatility from a first derivative isn't the problem. It's the consequence of volatility. Where it does become a problem is if people react to this illiquidity-induced sell-off. It's the consequence of volatility. It's a nuance, but it's if you are too emotional and react to it, that's when it does become a problem. But if you are getting rewarded for illiquidity, and it is a premium that you demand when you add up all of your returns, illiquidity is one of that you absolutely have to demand. If you're getting more than rewarded for that risk, then it's actually a good thing. So it's not, you think it's a negative automatically, that's the first interpretation. And I actually think you do get more than rewarded for that illiquidity that you are taking in the market. But there is an issue, and that's why you've got to look at how big is the fund manager that you're investing in. Can they be still nimble? Is that track record built on a much smaller fund and they can't do what they're doing anymore and they're a forced buyer of big stocks, which causes a positive feedback because they're getting fund flows that puff up the share price valuations of their existing stocks even more and more and more. So you have to look under the bonnet of these things. But generally, it's an issue, but I think it's always an issue. It is a bit more today. But again, everything's cyclical. I think it will find a way.
So what's your view on cash? You know, when the opportunities come along, don't you want cash there to be able to take up on them?
You do in one sense. The stock market's a strange animal. So when you walk past the shop and they put the sale sign in the window, everyone runs into it. But when the stock market puts the sale sign in the window, everyone runs out of it. And in Q4, I've seen a lot of investors seeing selling pressure. Rational thing to do, I'm raising cash as well. I'm going to sit it out. I'm going to wait for volatility to subside, then I'll get back in. And I think it'd be interesting if people are intellectually honest with themselves to actually run the figures and say, every time you've done that, has that actually added value or not? I would argue that time in the market is more important than trying to time the market. No one can time the market every single time. I think it's much better. And there's a technical reason I have to be 100% invested because it's for IHT reasons. So I can't use cash as a timing tool. And thank heavens for that, because if I did, I'd be rubbish at it. And I would guarantee my figures would be far worse than they actually are because I'd be jumping at shadows every single time. And you're getting your bid offer spread, which is a big cost in AIM as well. What I do instead, and I think it's much better, is there's a pendulum that flows between optimism and pessimism. And it's trying to get a handle on where we're at in that arc. And what comes back to what I was talking about earlier in terms of the altitude sickness, trying to scramble down the mountain into cheaper stocks. You can still be fully invested, but your construction, your portfolio can look manifestly different than what it did previously. So there's a time and a place for a buy and build strategy. There's a time and a place for a couple of turns of debt on the balance sheet, certainly earlier on in an economic cycle. Then you want to get more into very fortress-like balance sheets. So what you can do instead, and I think it's far better, is just have attack and defense into your mind. So rather than cash, move into more defensive type companies that will limit your downside in a sell-off, but then will participate in the upside when it comes. Now, they won't bounce as much as the stocks that got absolutely smashed, but because they're starting from a far higher level, point to point, you're going to end up in a better place. So we don't use cash as a timing tool. I think most investors shouldn't per se. Perhaps the only way of doing it is not to do it explicitly, but do it implicitly. I think Seth Klarman was a big fan of this, one of the gurus of value investing. And if you just can't see any good ideas, then you don't invest, obviously. So do it that way rather than saying, well, I don't like the market, it's selling off, I need to sell, I'll sell this company, I'll sell this company. You're probably going to sell the companies that are showing a profit and you're going to maintain the ones that are showing a loss, which is the wrong way of doing it anyway. Yeah. But that's just psychologically what you do. So you just killed your winners. You've taken these winners out, that market gone off another 3, 4, 5-fold over the next 5 years. So yeah, and I'm not a fan of using it as that. More respect for doing it implicitly rather than explicitly.
So when do you sell?
It's funny, isn't it? So there's millions of books on how to buy well, and there's probably less on how to sell investments. And again, there's a psychological reason for that, because the buying part's the exciting part. And then the selling part's almost an afterthought, which is strange because your buys are only defined by how well you actually sell. So from my perspective, fraud, gone. It's uninvestable. Malfeasance of any kind, it's gone. Accounting irregularities that are looking fairly significant, it's gone. That's why it certainly raised my eyebrow when Patricia Valerie managed to get that placing away after the issues had already hit it, and it had become uninvestable at that point. I've got a lot of sympathy in the sense of people wanted to throw some more money after it to try and shore up the bigger part of the value, the carrying value of their holdings, and they thought, well, it's a small amount of money, but it was just uninvestable. And then we know what happened to Patisserie Valerie. So yeah, it's tricky. The other aspect is when the balance sheet is deteriorated to a certain extent that you are no longer comfortable that they have enough downside protection. They may only be one more profit warning away from having to be a rescue rights issue. For example, integrity, if the management team is not acting with the integrity that I expect, I think integrity is everything, and without it, you bust. I use the expression character is destiny, and you can't fake it. You can get a lot of people paying lip service to it, but you can't fake it. Culture is very, 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 very important. I actually think good culture trumps a good strategy. You'll see, walk into reception, on the wall in reception, you'll see respect, integrity, values, and excellence. And you know what company had that in their reception?
Who was it?
Enron. So you can fake culture. So I look for that. If they do something that I think is not great, I've got a low tolerance for nil-priced share options. I think that's largesse, if not expropriation of wealth from shareholders. I just don't understand why they're allowed to do nil-priced options. I think it's grotesque. I think LTIPs have gone beyond where they should do. If you're not incentivised with a £250,000 to £500,000 salary, you shouldn't be in the job. What more incentive do you need? It's a ridiculous amount of money as well. So yeah, integrity is a big one for me, and that I do get grumpy if I see people not acting with the level of integrity that I want. Or other ones, I think they've overpaid for an acquisition. The best acquirers are very opportunistic. Buy and build is very, very difficult to do well. It causes all sorts of restructurings and exceptionals and that you're supposed to ignore, which is just fanciful. There's actual cash cost to them. I go out and celebrate my birthday and use the joint account with a girlfriend and buy 10 pints with it. I can try and blue in the face say it's just an exceptional. Normally I'd only pay for 4 pints, but well, it's a cash cost, isn't it? And I try and tell myself, with my hangover, it's an exceptional hangover, but it's still a cost in that sense. So I don't understand. I think it's a fetish with this exceptional. I think the brokers aren't pushing back aggressively enough against that. So if there's too much of a gap between headline earnings and statutory earnings, that's a red flag as well. And cash flow, if free cash flow or cash flow generation is just not adding up, if the receivables line is just far, far too big, or you've got accrued income becoming too big a part of your receivables book, it's just, it doesn't add up, it doesn't feel right. It's just, then you've got revenue recognition issues as well. So it's myriad things. There's no one thing in isolation, and sometimes it's a couple of things. Sometimes it's a pattern of behaviour. Sometimes you're giving them the benefit of the doubt. Sometimes it's just like a totting up process with a footballer, because they've done 5 fouls, you get a yellow card now. So sometimes it's like that.
What about slowing growth?
It depends. Slowing growth, it's back to this book in Bronco. It will, shares try and throw you off with unerring regularity, and you have to hold tight. And it's looking at the long-term horizon, and slowing growth, the share price overly reacts in my point of view. When it comes to slowing growth, what you need to ask is, has the long-term earnings generative ability of this company been impaired? If it has, sell it. If it hasn't, and there's a shorter term reason for the slowdown, then just sit tight with it. As long as there's a strong balance sheet and it's profitable and cash generative, it will recover over time. But you don't want to throw out, exceptional companies are rare, so they need to be treated exceptionally in that sense. And a slowing earnings growth, you have to look at it. What I'm much, much more sensitive to, if there's one metric to look at, is gross margin and an unexplained deterioration in gross margin. That's what got me out of Conviviality in the nick of time. At a very good price, thankfully, for my investors. Gross margin, gross profit. If you've got two companies that are identical in every respect, go for the one with the highest gross margin. And the good thing about gross margins is they are a lot more stable, or certainly should be, than sales. Sales growth has a big fade rate involved in it, whereas gross profits don't. And actually, as an aside, if you're looking for good turnaround candidates, if you've got a high gross profit company and a low operating profits are always easier to fix than gross profits. You know, if you've got a Me Too product on a 30% gross margin, try double your price. You're not going to. You can't change a 30% gross margin to 60% if you've got a rubbish product. what you can do, if you've got a 70% gross margin and a 4% operating margin, there's something in between that that's fixable. So that's a good turnaround candidate. So growth profits, that's what I do look for. So that would be a sell as well.
Are you tolerant to any figures of gross margin?
Yeah, to a degree. The more volatile the gross margin, though, it tells you that they are less, or they're more of a price taker than a price setter, or it also tells you that their cost of goods line is volatile. Mm. So we've seen that with Acrol, had a very elevated gross margin. Then we had a manager who dashed it up on the rocks. If you're looking at a turnaround situation, this is one of the best turnarounds in the making I've ever seen in terms of the chief exec and the exec chairman there. You have to put up with some, as long as there's a good explanation for it. But a chief exec will never tell you that the environment has just become a lot more competitive and we've had to cut prices. They will never admit to that. So that's why a gross margin deterioration is a wonderful canary in the coal mine. Look, in isolation, you might need more to sell it, but sometimes that's all you need to sell. And if the explanation isn't good enough, where it tells you if their customer's got more pricing power over them than they have over their suppliers, or... And this is why there's no magic bullet when it comes to investing. There's no hard and fast rule. There's so much nuance to it, and it becomes down to pattern recognition. And that only comes with experience. And the experience, you have to take your licks, you have to take your losses, and that's the best way to learn, unfortunately. But it's that pattern, it's experience, that pattern recognition. I can't use a better expression from it.
And do you top slice?
We do. Max position, we take in the portfolios 5%, and then if it gets up to 7.5%, we will reduce it back down to 5%. Or it might be an outright sell at that point. It depends. I don't use price targets. I think they're too concentrating on the numerator. You've also got the PE to bear in mind. So I do look at where's the PE come from, where it's got to, what do I think the PE can get to, because sentiment is... Certainly, over 3 to 5 years, sentiment is a large part of a share price movement. Longer than that, 5 to 10 years, it becomes about the return on capital employed, becomes the much bigger driver. But that's a weak force in the short to medium terms, a bit like gravity. Gravity is a weak but strong force. Rocky is as well.
What about averaging down? Do you have a stop? Do you average down? What happens if the price starts sinking?
Very rarely average. But we will do it where we think, back to this elastic, where we think it's stretched too far on the downside. If you're looking for states, the ideal state is for something that's cheap and going up in value. It may still be hated by a lot of people, but it's cheap and going up in value. It's the single best place to be. The next best place to be, perversely, is expensive and going up in value. The next best place to be is cheap and going down in value. And the worst place to be is expensive and going down in value. Mm. So we much prefer, because momentum is everything in life. You see it in sports games, a momentum shift. We've seen it with England, Scotland, unfortunately, in the rugby. Talk about a momentum shift there, but you see it. Momentum is everything. That's why we're very, very nervous. If you're going against the crowd, if you've got a multi-year bear market, not a sudden collapse, but just an insidious, constant drip, drip, lower, 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 with some profit warnings thrown in, you're almost being arrogant by buying, and all of those people on the other side of that trade are wrong. That's what you're explicitly saying. If you're buying, you're catching the falling knife, whatever. We much prefer to buy when it's had a upgrade and it's now back on track, and you may be paying at year highs, 52-week highs, but what you've done is dramatically reduced your downside risk, and you've still got pretty meaningful upside from there. So we are very, very nervous about averaging. We certainly wouldn't do it until we've seen either capitulation selling, or we've seen company actually upgrade for the first time in a long time, or another good early warning system. Has the share price stopped going down on bad news? It can just tell you all the weak hands now have been thrown out of it. Something's actually maybe transitioning here. Maybe time to look at it. And sometimes stocks are just fundamentally misunderstood. I think NAHL has fallen into that bracket, and that's probably one of my highest conviction stocks as we stand today. I think it's one of the best restructuring stories on AIM. There's all sorts of plaudits for it. I think that's got 3, 4, 5-fold upside over five years now. I think it's fantastic, fantastic business. And that comes again because free cash flow was negative. Market hates negative free cash flow, even though you're creating a more sustainable business down the road. But we're close to inflecting on that now.
But regulation's gone against it. Is it good to invest in an area where regulation goes against a company?
Not on the day it happens. and it comes back, there's a very prolonged period where they've re-engineered their business model. NAHL have been operating in that sector and they've done it before. And that gives you comfort. They had to re-engineer the business model before. They've proved that they can. What it has done is it's collapsed the profitability from road traffic accidents, but that wasn't their core anyway. Their core is non-road traffic accidents. People are still having accidents, unfortunately. People still deserve recompense for that where it's not their fault. And people still need guidance for what is a complex legal system. So it's become much more of a volume game for them. They're highly, highly automated. They've designed their business now from a blank piece of paper, so there's no legacy spaghetti IT issues or crazy ways of doing things. It's highly end-to-end, highly automated, so it's very cheap for them to service. And they're increasingly now, because NAHL used to just be a originator of leads and give it on to solicitors, and they got paid immediately for giving them that lead. Mm. Now they are turning into the solicitor. They've just been allowed to set up their own law firm. So then now, while it's capital consumptive, and for the first 15 months, you're hitting your costs, but you don't see any benefit on the revenue. Once the admission or liability hits, then you start to recognise the revenue, and then 3 months after the cash comes through. So you've had this very long gestation period, and you're now just starting to see the end of that. So their work in progress is now starting to convert into cash. Market loves cash, becomes a lot more visible. The discount rate that you apply to those cash flows fall because of that visibility, which increases your share price. So it is actually good. Sometimes it favours the incumbents regulation, or more often than not, NHL was one of the bigger operators. When you have a big, big shock to the system, smaller players can't re-engineer their models. They don't have the balance sheet to do so. So actually, they're now going to be in a far better place than they were pre the regulation because the competition is a lot less now going forward.
So what do you think is the most important criteria of any stock you're going to buy into?
I've kind of changed my thinking on this one. And it might sound boring, but just sheer bloody mindedness, endurance and sustainability. I think that is the absolute key. And there's a stark fact that around half the companies in the public market don't survive for 10 years. And that's an incredible hurdle. Now, some of them would have been taken over, but most of them have gone bust. So business is tough, but endurance, and it comes back to, I think it was Darwin who said, it's not the strongest or most intelligent that survive, it's the most adaptable. And that's what we look for in business. It's those that are adaptable have survived. And by survive, it's a bit of a truism, but just by surviving, you've got more years and years and years of excess returns or compounded returns or dividends or special dividends, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just sheer determination to endure. And that's where smaller companies actually have an advantage over the bigger companies because they have a nimbleness and they can re-engineer their business models a lot quicker than a very, very large company which is tied down in bureaucracy and the decision-making process becomes entrenched and gummed up. So yeah, it's just sustainability.
And in terms of your strategy, how often do you have to redesign it? Because the market changes and you have to change your strategy accordingly.
Yeah, within a wider kind of framework. So it's defence or attack, it's value and growth. It's strong balance sheet. We're always, though, invested in profitable companies. Hopefully the top line's growing. If there isn't, then the core part of the business is growing, but it's being masked by something else. They can be good situations as well. But cash, cash, cash. Cash is king, and it took me a while to get onto just how important it was, but it absolutely is. A profit isn't a profit unless it's cash-backed. But moreover, when we talk about diversification, what we also want to populate our portfolio where there's different stocks that do different things at different points in the cycle. So you want your stocks that have a potential for unlimited upside, not over 1 year, over 3 or 5 years, but over 10 or 15 or 20 years if they're allowed to be listed for that long. And those types of stocks, you want high repeat purchase sales, you want very strong IP wrapping those products. And I would throw Tristel and Strix Group into those. I think they're both wonderful businesses for different reasons. You have to really get under the bonnet on both of them, in particular Strix, which looks dull on the face of it, but it's an incredibly high-tech company with very, very strong patents, and there's some disruption in terms of their new product development pipeline that's coming through. You want stocks that have the ability to go exponential. D4, T4, we think, fits into that bucket. You want growth at a reasonable price. Quixent, Quartix. Thankfully, there's nothing called Quixotic. But I definitely put those into that bucket. And then you want out-and-out value stocks or turnaround situations. SureServe would be one of them. And then you want compounders. You want long-term compounders who can generate 20% plus return on capital employed, but reinvest them and continue to earn those high rates of return. And I'd throw IG Design into that. I think he's probably the best CEO on AIM at IG Design. And it also Alpha FX, which is flying under the radar of quite a few investors. I think this is compounding its top line at 50% for the last several years. And I think it will continue to do very, very strong levels of growth. And it's all organic as well. Incredible culture that they've built there. Very high performing team. Very, very good at what they do. So it's a bit of a smorgasbord in that respect, but actually it comes back to the blend of the portfolio. And I think that's how you increase robustness into your performance.
So going forward, what do you see for the stock market over the next year?
I'd love to ask you, what do you see? It's a fool's errand trying to predict any 12 to 18 month view on the stock market. All I'd say is valuations have become a lot more sensible. We're seeing all sorts of good ideas. Give you a stat, the PE for our AIM IHT strategy was 20 times this time last year, 20 times earnings. Today, as it stands, it's 16, and that's going to fall over time. There's more stocks that are on pretty compelling valuations, so it's a lot better time to invest now than it perhaps was then in that sense of it. But this is talking 3, 5, 10 years out. All I would say is we are very, very bullish on UK PLC, UK equity. You don't necessarily have to be bullish on the UK economy, and that seems incongruous, but it comes back to, in the same way the map isn't the territory, the stock market isn't the economy, and we just think there's too much pessimism priced in and baked into domestic. And there's one chart that I keep referring back to, it's FTSE local versus the FTSE 100. The FTSE local index, it's where 70% of their sales come domestically. Just trying to find a bottom now, relatively. It's been in a terrible bear market, as you'd expect, post June 2016. It's trying to find a bottom now. But there's, as I say, when the news flow looks positive, people are just jumping at it. If we get a resolution, you're going to see a very, very quick, short, well, maybe hopefully not short, but a very, very sharp rally in all sorts of domestic names. So I think it's going to pay you to get in now rather than wait.
Stephen, that was tremendous, and it certainly was wisdom. Thank you very much.
You're too kind, Andy. Thank you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.